From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Terry Tempest Williams' family life has been intertwined with the landscape of the Great Salt Lake Desert. The desert was refuge, but it was also downwind from atomic bomb tests. Williams thinks it's no coincidence that 7 women in her family have had cancer. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Terry Tempest Williams. She's written a memoir called Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. Also today, Mr. Pink. We talk with actor Steve Buscemi. He co-stars with Harvey Keitel in the new film Reservoir Dogs. And music that is both recognizable and unlike anything you've ever heard. World music critic Milo Miles plays movie music from India. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration has secretly appointed an independent counsel to investigate the search of Bill Clinton's passport files during the presidential election campaign. Government sources told NPR that Attorney General William Barr has chosen Joseph DeGeneva, a former U.S. attorney, to conduct the probe. The sources said the probe was authorized after the Justice Department concluded there was some evidence of criminal intent. Today, CBS, The New York Times, and The Washington Post asked the judicial panel that named DeGeneva to reveal the conditions of his appointment. The secrecy over the appointment has raised speculation that Attorney General Barr has called for a far more restrictive investigation than one that might have been conducted by a counsel appointed by the Clinton administration. President-elect Clinton is continuing to meet with prospective cabinet appointees in Little Rock. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Wisconsin Democrat Les Aspin has arrived in Little Rock. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee is considered to be a top candidate for defense secretary. It's expected that Clinton will announce his national security team by Christmas. Others who have been mentioned as possible picks for defense and foreign policy posts include Warren Christopher, Clinton's transition director for Secretary of State, Mount Holyoke professor and former Carter administration official Anthony Lake for national security advisor, and Oklahoma Representative Dave McCurdy for CIA director. Clinton is also continuing to sort through economic policy options prepared for him by his advisors. In a Wall Street Journal article today, Clinton indicated that he would trim his spending and investment plans rather than increase the deficit if the tax increases and defense cuts he's proposed don't add up to the 50% reduction in the deficit over 4 years. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
The United States and the European Community have set a new deadline for completing global trade negotiations, mid-January. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Negotiators from the 108 nations of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade had hoped to agree on lower trade barriers and modernized rules of commerce by the end of this year, but won't be able to. To give the so-called Uruguay round of talks a boost, President Bush met at the White House today with Prime Minister John Major of Britain, which currently holds the rotating presidency of the European Community.
I think there has been some feeling over recent days that for one reason or another, uncertainties, concerns in some countries, that the Uruguay round might somehow be slipping away when agreement looked as though it was near. We addressed those particular problems this morning.
President Bush underscored the importance of meeting the mid-January deadline by noting that a trade agreement could increase world economic output by $5 trillion over the next decade. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 44 points to close at 3,313. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. Reports from Somalia say that the U.S.-led military coalition is widely expected to make its next move into the southern Somali port city of Kismayu. The Associated Press quoted military sources who said that an advance team of U.S. Air Force personnel has already flown to Kismayu to check the condition of the airport. Relief agencies have urged American commanders to take over the port, which is about 400 miles south of Mogadishu. Foreign aid workers have been driven out of Kismayu by heavy fighting twice in the past 2 weeks. The city's considered an important link to other southern towns that are hard hit by famine. Russian President Boris Yeltsin says that a START II treaty to cut the strategic nuclear arsenals of Russia and the United States could be signed early next year. President Yeltsin was speaking today in Beijing at the end of 2 days of talks with Chinese leaders. Carrie Grace reports from Beijing.
President Yeltsin told journalists in Beijing he had no reservations about the START II treaty and was ready to sign it in January, although he said the exact details of the signing ceremony had yet to be worked out and warned that Russia could not be expected to shoulder alone the costs of dismantling two-thirds of its strategic nuclear arsenal. At a NATO meeting in Brussels, U.S. Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger said he was unaware that any deal had been reached with Moscow. The Russian president devoted the rest of his Beijing news conference to details of the 24 agreements between Russia and China signed during his visit, agreements covering issues ranging from military cooperation to trade and nuclear energy. For National Public Radio, this is Carrie Gracie in Beijing.
President Bush has sent congratulations to South Korean President-elect Kim Young-sam. The former opposition leader was elected today to succeed President No Tae-woo. He'll be South Korea's first civilian president in more than three decades. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The clan of the one-breasted women is how Terry Tempest Williams sometimes refers to her family. Her mother, her grandmothers, and six aunts have had mastectomies. Seven of those women were killed by cancer. Williams has had two breast biopsies. A small tumor between her ribs was a borderline malignancy. Her mother died of ovarian cancer years after her bout with breast cancer. Terry Tempest Williams is the author of the memoir Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. It's a memoir of the year her mother died. It's about family, the natural world, faith, and politics. Williams lives in Utah near the Great Salt Lake. She's a fifth-generation Mormon. She says most statistics tell us breast cancer is genetic. What they don't say is that living in Utah may be the greatest hazard of all. That leads us to a recurring dream Williams used to have about a flash of light.
I did have this recurring dream of this flash of light in the night in the desert, and I had it over and over and over. And one night my father and I were having dinner, and I said, you know, it's the strangest thing, I keep having this recurring dream. And I explained it to him, and he looked at me very matter-of-factly and said, you did see it. And I said, saw what? And he said, the bomb. The cloud. I remember the day we were coming home from California, September 7th, 1957. You were sitting on your mother's lap. She was pregnant. And it was a few hours before dawn. We saw this explosion. I thought the oil tanker in front of us had blown up. We pulled over, and suddenly rising out of the desert was this golden-stemmed cloud, the mushroom. And he said there was this eerie pink glow, and within seconds, suddenly there was this light ash raining on the car. I was stunned. And he looked at me and he said, I thought you knew that. It was a common occurrence in the 50s. And I think it was at that moment I realized the deceit I had been living with, that all of us of this generation had been living with, growing up in the American Southwest, drinking contaminated milk from contaminated cows. And as I say, even the breasts of our mothers, members years later of the clan of one-breasted women. I had no idea, Terry.
Do you know which blast this was that you had witnessed unknowingly?
It was. I do. And I actually researched it to find out if that date was accurate. And it was. It was Operation Plumb Bob, one of the most extensive tests to ever be enlisted during that time in the 1950s through 1962.
I guess it's amazing to me that your family would have been driving along through the desert, see a nuclear bomb explosion, and not talk about it all the time afterwards.
Isn't that, I mean, to me that just shows that was the myth and the time we were living through. And when you talk to people who live in St. George, it was entertainment. I mean, they would climb to a particular ridge, and a few hours before dawn, they would watch the nuclear bomb as though it were fireworks, sitting on top of high schools, lovers that would go park. I mean, the stories are endless of the days when you could really watch that phenomenon with no knowledge of what it was really doing to them.
Did memories come back to you after your father told you what happened?
It was as though I had been punched in the stomach, and it took my breath away, and then I remembered. And what was so interesting is that from that moment on, I have never had that dream since. It was almost like that dream was just calling this to consciousness. And once he told me that story, it was out. And my life was dramatically altered.
So what did you remember?
I think what I remembered was the terror. And I must have imprinted on just the magnitude of that light. And the only thing I can tell you, even that young, was that it was so unearthly that it absolutely, it went right into my bones on a cellular level.
7 women in your family have died of breast cancer.
Yes.
You've had 2 biopsies yourself.
Yes.
Do you think it's connected to the nuclear bomb tests?
I can't prove that it is, but I can't prove that it isn't. And when you look at the statistics in Utah of those individuals who have died of cancer after 1960, I have no doubt in my mind. And I look at those in my generation, you look at the obituaries in Utah, and it is daily. I think we were used by our government, and when the Atomic Energy Commission said it is virtually uninhabited desert terrain, my family, my generation, were some of the virtual uninhabitants.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Terry Tempest Williams, and her new book is called Refuge in a Natural History of Family and Place. When your mother was dying, she thought of death in a very spiritual sense and of course, didn't think of her illness politically at all. On the eve of her surgery, she asked your grandmother, who had also been through breast surgery, what to expect. What did your grandmother tell her?
I remember I was 15 years old at the time, and my grandmother was staying with us that night. I have 3 younger brothers, the youngest being 4. The telephone rang. I picked it up at the same time my grandmother did, and my mother said, "What can I expect?" My grandmother had also had a mastectomy, and she said, "Diane, it's one of the most spiritual experiences you will ever encounter."
And when your mother came out of surgery, that proved to be true for her. What did she tell you?
We met her in the lobby of the hospital, and I remember her radiance. And she said, "Children, I want you to know I have felt the arms of God around me." And we believed her. My father cried, and we believed her. And at that time, she was 38 years old.
How old are you now?
I'm 37.
So what did it mean to you when she said that? Was that comforting?
You have to understand, you know, we were, at that time, I was a very devout Mormon. That was how we had been raised. My grandmother had had cancer. My aunt had had cancer. It was a fact of life. So it was both horrifying to me because suddenly the thought of not having a mother was terrifying. It was as though this plastic dome of safety had shattered. And yet as I looked into her eyes and I saw her peace and calm, I think my impression, Terry, was there is something here I don't understand. And it was more about listening.
In your book, you write that in Mormon culture, authority is respected, obedience is revered, and independent thinking is not. Through your mother's death and through your knowledge soon after that of your exposure to nuclear bomb tests, you had this kind of like dual sense of death and illness. One is a kind of spiritual understanding that it can be a kind of transcendent experience to go through with an open mind and an open heart and everything, the kind of suffering of death. But at the same time, you're starting to think that there were all political reasons why your mother was going through the suffering, and it had to do with the exposure to radiation. What kind of challenge did that present to your sense of faith, which, as you say, wasn't about questioning authority? And that's exactly what you started to do after your mother died, was question the authority of the government who decided to have these bomb blasts not too far from where people were living.
It gave me a focus, because I think there's a lot of anger that comes when you watch someone suffer, whether you acknowledge it or not. And when I realized that it may have, in fact, been because of our government's lying and the above-ground testing, suddenly I wanted to know everything about that. And so it really directed my energy in a very concrete way. And I made a decision to go down to the test site to see for myself what was there, and ultimately to make the decision to commit civil disobedience, which I did. I must say, there were foreshadowings along the way. I remember a year prior to Mother's death, Mother and my grandmother and I were in St. George, and we were there when the Great Peace March came through. And we actually joined them for maybe a half a mile. And it was the first time I had ever heard my mother or grandmother sing outside of church. And I remember that morning we were going to go out bird watching in a place called Beaver Dam Wash, but we had heard over the radio that night that there was going to be another nuclear test, and we made the decision not to go because of the venting that occurs. So it was almost like subconsciously we knew we were part of this story, and yet consciously we'd never spoke of it. And yet here we were marching a year before, and a year later I was arrested. And after being released in Nevada, I met my grandmother in St. George, and I will never forget her opening the door and putting her arms around me and just sobbing, saying, "Thank you, what you've done for all of us." And then my uncle, who was a vet from World War II, walking out of the room.
In anger?
Yes.
What was he angry about?
Our family is a very staunch Republican Mormon family, and for him it was an outrage. It was the ultimate act of betrayal.
Have you been able to keep your Mormon faith and challenge authority at the same time?
I think I take my cue from Octavio Paz when he says that revolution requires both love and criticism. So there are many aspects of the Mormon culture that I love, that notion of family, community, and there are other aspects that I find extremely problematic with the patriarchy. So it's a difficult question and it's a complicated answer. And all I can tell you is that for now I've chosen to remain inside the church with a voice, but I think at some personal cost.
Have you been criticized by people in the church?
Yes.
But not excommunicated?
Not excommunicated.
You're a fifth-generation Mormon. Is it very important to you to keep in that tradition? Because it means, not only means keeping the faith, it means keeping a family tradition.
It's all about family. It really is. And my family's all in Utah, and my ancestors' bones are buried there. And I think as long as you can keep a sense of humor, and as I say, keep pushing the boundaries, that's my life. That's where I come from. And it certainly is not perfect, but it really is what gives me sustenance and strength. And particularly in the American West, I mean, the Mormon people came to Utah for religious sovereignty. And I think they have an enormous sense of place and community. And I think there's a great deal to learn from Mormon culture and history. But I also think there's a great deal to contend with and to question and to provoke.
My guest is Terry Tempest Williams. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Terry Tempest Williams is my guest. In your book, Refuge, your story kind of alternates between your mother dying of cancer and you as a naturalist in residence at a bird refuge, talking about how the Great Salt Lake had risen and had flooded, and that was affecting the whole kind of natural scape of the area. What connections did you see between those two events in your life?
In the spring of 1983, Great Salt Lake rose to record heights, and the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge in northern Utah was flooded. That was the landscape of my childhood. Every year, every season, my grandmother and I would go and watch the long-legged birds. Avocets, stilts, ibises, curlews, herons, exotic birds. At that same time, in the spring of 1983, Mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And I'm not sure I did see the connection. All I knew is that I was splitting my time between keeping vigil at the hospital with Mother and going out the lake to see the birds. And at some point, I remember walking out to the refuge thinking, this will never be the same. This will never be the same. And as the water lapped up around my ankles, I could not separate the boundaries between the bird refuge that was drowning and my family that was in this landscape of grief. And devastation knows no boundaries. And it was all the same to me.
What happened to the bird population?
It declined radically. I mean, basically, the refuge was devastated. And the birds, many of them were displaced. Many went up to Malheur in Oregon and different places. But we lost an enormous amount of, we lost all of our wetlands, and we really did lose a huge population of the birds. But I'm happy to report, you know, 10 years later, the birds are making a comeback. The marshes are slowly returning. And to me, it is that power of regeneration that gives us hope and allows us to find refuge in change.
I'm going to ask you to read a section of your book that's it's a very moving passage that's really a journal entry, I believe. And this is about the day that your mother died and spending those last moments of her life with her. Would that be okay to read?
Yes. I'm going to be reading from my journal entry, Friday, January 16th, 1987. Walking into her room, I could see death was imminent, and I was surprised to see the physical changes from the night before. Her color had changed, especially around the mouth and nose. Her face was waxen, her feet were cold. It was as though dying moves from your toes upward. Mother's breathing was regular, but strained, as she exhaled. So much going out, so little coming in. I knelt at the foot of her bed with the soles of her feet pressed against my forehead. It was the only place I could feel her pulse. I rubbed her legs under the mohair blanket. They were like ice. Dad paced the room, occasionally sitting next to her to hold her hand. We took turns. From 1 until 4 in the afternoon, we sat near her, a meditation. Her breaths could now be heard as moans. Her eyes were haunting, open and clear. Time was suspended like watching a fire. Gradually, Mother's breaths became a mantra, and the death mask we feared was removed. My father spoke of what it had meant to him to take care of our own. In these hours, we began to realize the magnitude of these past weeks, months, years. Talk of everyday life crept in, basketball scores, the day's news, even laughter, and there, Mother lay, dying. I never doubted her presence. The light in the room deepened. It occurred to me that Mother would wait until after sunset, and it was an exquisite one. An apricot aura radiated above the purple ochre range. I told Mother what a beautiful sunset it was. I recalled her applause on another afternoon. We turned a small lamp on. Mother's color looked better, and for a moment we believed she would never die. The belabored breathing continued. We took turns holding her hands, rubbing her forehead, moistening her mouth, and we could feel the cold moving up her body. Her head was turned now, and with each breath her head drew back, reminding me of the swallow I beheld at Bear River, moments before it died. Dad began to get nervous. He worried that Mother could go on for a few more days, that we had kept vigil too many times. He smiled with an anxious grin, saying, "Diane, you may outlast me yet." Our eyes met, death eyes. I looked into them, eyes wide with knowledge, unblinking, objective eyes, eyes detached from the soul, eyes turned inward. I moved from the chaise across the room and sat cross-legged on the bed next to her. I took her right hand in mine and whispered, "Okay, Mother, let's do it." I began breathing with her. It began simply as a mirroring of her breath, taking the exertion of her exhale, ah, and reflecting back a more peaceful expression. Ah, Mother and I became one breathing organism. Everything we had ever shared in our lives manifested itself in this moment, in each breath, here and now. I was stunned by the way her eyes fixed on mine, the duet we were engaged in. At other times, I just closed my eyes and merged with her, whispering once again, "Let go, Mother, let go." But mostly, it was just breath. Slowing down, quieting down, until only the sweetest, faintest expressions of breath remained. Eric Fromm writes, "The whole life of the individual is nothing but the process of giving birth to himself. Indeed, we should fully be born when we die." A full moon hung in a starlit sky. It was Mother's face illumined.
That's a really beautiful passage, and I thank you for reading it. I know when you wrote this book, one of the things you did was show it to the members of your family and ask them to help you edit it. I think that's a very kind of gracious, generous thing to do when you're writing about people and about their lives. What kind of knowledge about each other came out of that? Do you know what I mean? About showing them your book in which you wrote about your mother and her death and your thoughts about other people in the family.
I think it provoked a great deal of discussion. I think we are not accustomed to death. We don't have that opportunity to be with death. And I think because our family had two chances, the first chance in 1971 when Mother had breast cancer, we shied away from it. We did not do well. The second time, I think it was a very conscious decision as a family that we wanted to face this with Mother head on. And we did the best we could, having no idea what territory we were entering. And I think we were all very raw after that experience. I felt that it was only fair if I was telling this story that my family be part of it and that they have veto power of those things that they were not comfortable with. And there's a very fine line between what is personal and what is private. And I think the most powerful aspects of this story in Refuge were the ones I did not tell. What did it reveal of my family's character? I remember giving my father the first draft as I was heading on a plane for New York to give it to my editor as well. When I got to the hotel, the red light was flashing. I called my father. He was outraged, saying he couldn't believe what I had told, that he looked like a hothead. You know, he was furious about the fact that I had mentioned he had cried. What would his men think who worked for him? And then he said, "And then your brother would like to talk to you." And my brother got on the phone, and I said, "And?" And he said, "I can't believe what a minor character I am." You know, so I think we all had our issues to deal with. But I think in the end, my family realized this was my story, and the story that they would have to tell would be very different. But I think as a family, we emerged with a sense of wholeness, a sense that each day is a gift, and that we must live our lives with unguarded hearts, and that also a revolutionary character is essential to our own survival, that blind obedience in the name of patriotism or religion ultimately takes our lives. And I think our family, having gone through this experience of watching the women around us die slow, heroic deaths, has made us much more fierce and much more compassionate, with that notion that grief does dare us to love once more, and it is a love that is wild.
Could you ever imagine yourself moving away from Utah?
Terry, I can't. I really love Utah. It's my home. I am deeply committed to it. I think it's about residency. And it's about really digging in. I mean, sometimes I think the most radical act we can commit is to stay home, because then we can be mindful of the changes that are occurring. And we have a voice, and we know the myths, and we know the language, and we know the stories.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Terry Tempest Williams' memoir is Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, playing nerds and seedy types. We talk with actor Steve Buscemi. He co-stars with Harvey Keitel in the heist film Reservoir Dogs. And it's got salsa, disco, country, reggae, and strings. World music critic Milo Miles plays movie music from India. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Somalia, U.S. troops appear ready to move into the coastal city of Kismayo in the southern part of the nation in order to provide security for aid efforts there. NPR's Deborah Wong reports from Mogadishu.
Western relief officials say that U.S. and European troops plan to move into the town of Kismayo sometime over the weekend. Today, a U.S. reconnaissance team reportedly landed at the airport. U.S. military officials refused comment. Kismayo is a major port city in the south. In recent days, it has been the scene of bitter fighting between rival clans who appear to be vying for control of the city in anticipation of the arrival of the multinational force. Armed gunmen have repeatedly looted relief supplies, and most Western relief workers have been evacuated from the city. Meanwhile, in the capital, Mogadishu, sources say the U.S.-led force is preparing to cross the city's Green Line and establish a permanent presence in the northern section of the city. Relief workers have been urging the troops to move into the north, where security is still a problem. I'm Deborah Wong in Mogadishu.
Some 400 Palestinians expelled from Israel are facing their second night without shelter in no man's land. Lebanon, in consultation with Syria, is refusing to accept them. The expulsions occurred after a radical group killed a border guard, and Israeli officials are determined that they will not be allowed back. Jim Muir, the BBC, reports from Lebanon.
On a bleak and barren stretch of hillside in the no-man's land, the Palestinians, all of them devout Muslims, were chanting Islamic slogans and singing patriotic songs to keep their spirits up as a cold rain came down. The International Red Cross is mounting an emergency operation to put up tents so that the Palestinians at least have some shelter from the wintry conditions, and also to provide them with some food, water, and blankets. Many of the expelled Palestinians are highly qualified professionals, including many doctors and teachers. Most of them said they'd been taken from their homes, often in the middle of the night, and expelled without warning. Some of them admitted to being supporters of Hamas or the Islamic Jihad, but others said they were simply devout Muslims. None of them seemed unduly dismayed at spending a long period stranded in this desolate no-man's land. One said it would dramatize and win sympathy for their cause and deter the Israelis from carrying out further mass expulsions.
Jim Muir, the BBC. There were nearly 5 million new immigrants to the United States between 1985 and 1990. The Census Bureau says that 7.9% of the population is now foreign-born, compared to 6.2% in 1980. Almost one-third of those born in other countries live in California and New York. Nearly 22% of those born in other nations come from Mexico, with many of the newest Americans from Asia and Latin America. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials climbed 44 points to close at 3,313. This is NPR News. President Bush and British Prime Minister John Major have set a new deadline for winding up world trade talks. At a meeting today at the White House, the two leaders set a deadline of mid-January for agreement after deciding to resume the talks early next month. There had been a feeling in the Bush administration that the trade talks were going so badly in Geneva that U.S. diplomats might be called home. Earlier today, the head of the World Trade Organization conducting the talks said that they would not be completed by the end of the year. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, President-elect Bill Clinton put forward a number of proposals designed to cut the federal budget deficit, some of which could prove to be controversial. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
Clinton is apt to raise eyebrows with some of his proposals for trimming the deficit, which he never mentioned in his presidential campaign. He now says he may seek to raise the retirement age for receiving Social Security benefits from 65 to 67. By forcing people to work two more years before they can collect Social Security, Clinton said the government could save $60 billion over the next two decades. He said raising the retirement age would be justified because people are living longer after they retire than when the Social Security system started. Clinton also said in the interview he would consider taxing capital gains on homes and other assets when a person dies. Property is now exempt from capital gains taxation when people leave it to their children. Clinton said he would stand by his campaign pledge for a middle-class tax cut, but gave it lukewarm support, saying it would do little to boost the economy. And he didn't rule out an increased gas tax. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
Officials at Boeing say Japan's All Nippon Airlines has ordered seven Boeing 737. Orders for the new planes, along with options, come to some $660 million. So far this year, the company has received orders for more than 240 new planes. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Actor Steve Buscemi has the kind of face you remember. His big eyes and wide lips are set off by a very pale complexion. Most of his films have been offbeat, independent productions like Call Me, Parting Glances, and Jim Jarmusch's Mystery Train. He played the performance artist in Martin Scorsese's segment in New York Stories. He was the bellboy in Barton Fink. Now he's co-starring with Harvey Keitel in Reservoir Dogs, a brutal and perversely funny updating of the heist film. Lawrence Tierney plays the mastermind who brings together several men who don't know each other to rob a jewelry store. To keep their anonymity, Tierney gives them each the name of a color. Buscemi is Mr. Pink, Keitel is Mr. White. Vincent Canby praised the film for its sometimes dazzling cinematic pyrotechnics and over-the-top dramatic energy. In this scene, Buscemi, Keitel, and two of the other thieves are hiding out in a warehouse. The heist went wrong. They think they were betrayed. Keitel and Mr. Blonde, played by Michael Madsen, are accusing each other of being the rat. Buscemi tries to stop them from fighting.
Are you going to bark all day, little doggy? Or are you going to bite?
What was that?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch it. Would you repeat it?
Are you going to bark all day, little doggy? Or are you going to bite?
Oh, Christ. Hey, look, you two assholes, calm the down. Hey, come on, back up.
What, are we on a playground here, huh? Am I the only professional?
You said yourself you thought about taking him out.
Said that.
Yeah, I did, okay? I did. But that was then. Right now, this guy is the only one I completely trust.
You taking his side?
No! F*** sides, man! What we need here is a little solidarity. Somebody sticking a red-hot poker up our asses. I want to know whose name's on the handle. Look, I know I'm no piece of shit. I'm pretty sure you're okay. Let's try and figure out who the bad guy is, all right?
Wow. That was really exciting. I bet you're a big Lee Marvin fan, aren't you?
Yeah, me too. I love that guy.
Tell us the story of your audition for Reservoir Dogs.
Well, I almost didn't get in on it because they were casting that in L.A., and I was in New York working on another film called In the Soup, and I wasn't able to go to L.A. to audition. And they couldn't afford to come to New York. But Harvey, out of his own pocket, paid for Quentin and Lawrence Bender, the producer, to come to New York, and they looked at a bunch of New York actors. And I got in there and did the first audition and then was called back and went in a couple of days later. And before I went in the room, Quentin said to me, he says, "You know, Steve, Mr. Pink is the part that I wrote for myself." Because, I mean, originally he was going to do this movie for $30,000 in 16mm, and he was going to play Pink. So he says, "I'm not going to give this part away. Whoever plays this part is going to have to take it from me." He says, "I hope that doesn't make you nervous." And so...
Did it?
It did, actually. I mean, I was, you know, after he kind of went into the room, I sat there saying, "Now what do I do? You know, do I go in there and with a gun and say, give me the part, you know?" But I did my audition, and he told me later that my audition was good, but I didn't exactly blow them away. But when they were deciding on who would be in this gang of thieves, Quentin just felt that I look like a thief. That it was believable to him that Lawrence Tierney's character would pick me to do this job. So that's ultimately why I got it. I mean, he had seen my other work, so he knew I was a capable actor. And he just really believed that I looked like a thief and that I could pull it off.
Well, how do you take to that?
Oh, I like it. It's a compliment.
It is?
Yeah.
So what scene did you do during the audition?
The pink scene I did was when he first comes into the warehouse and saying that there's a rat in the house.
So tell me, why is it a compliment to be told that you look like a thief?
Well, I guess for me, I never saw myself as kind of a tough guy, and certainly growing up, I was not the tough guy. So it kind of tickles me that I'm, you know, can play these parts. And if someone thinks that I look that tough, then I kind of take that as a compliment.
How did you look when you were growing up?
Well, I... not that I want to perpetuate this... I've been told I look like Don Knotts a lot. and if you've seen the movie In the Soup, that's there's a line that Jim Jarmusch has. Actually, he plays a producer for this TV talk show, this cable TV talk show where the guests are nude, and he says I look like a young Don Knotts. So I mean, I have this, and it's funny, you know, like the parts that I've played in films, I've either kind of played the nerdy type or the seedy type.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I have both those sides to me, but I kind of look for roles that are kind of in the middle of that. And for me, Reservoir Dogs was because I don't see Mr. Pink as... I mean, first of all, I don't see him as just a tough guy. I mean, I don't even think that... you know, he doesn't go around kind of acting tough. I mean, he's a pretty sensible guy. He's very intelligent. When push comes to shove, I mean, he does have the toughness there. You know, he does have what it takes to be in that profession.
He has nerve.
Yeah, he's got a lot of nerve.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Steve Buscemi, and he's starring in two independent films now, Reservoir Dogs and In the Soup. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor Steve Buscemi is my guest. You actually started as a comic, didn't you?
Well, I started out going to acting school. You know, I always wanted to be an actor. And I got into comedy as a way of, you know, it just seemed like a way of breaking in to show business. It was a way of creating my own work. You know, I could write it myself, perform it myself, and so that's what I did, and I did that on and off for like two years. But I found that I didn't really like it that much. And then I met this actor named Mark Boone Jr., and we started writing and performing our own material, not stand up. We did more one act plays and some longer version plays and. And then I also worked a lot in experimental theater in downtown New York with the Wooster Group, another playwright, director named John Jezerin, and just did a lot of theater.
I know you took a break from performing for a while and you worked as a fireman in Little Italy. What prompted that?
Well, I had taken the test for it when I was about 18. This is when I was living in Long Island at home. My father made me take the test. He works for the sanitation department, so he was big on civil service jobs. So I took the test and then kind of forgot about it And then 4 years later, when I was living in the city, my name came up on the list. And at that time, I was working for a furniture moving company during the day, going to the stand-up clubs at night. And I just really, I mean, it was hard, and I just needed a change. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity for change. It's not like I always wanted to be a firefighter. But I took the job, and it turned out it was a great job. And I really loved doing it, and I loved the guys that I worked with. I worked at Engine 55, like you say, on Broome Street. And it was a great experience.
What did you love about it?
I liked the guys that I worked with. They were real characters. My first year on the job, I kind of kept the low profile, and I'm kind of a quiet person, and so they had no idea that I was an actor. And I would just observe them. They were so funny, and I mean, they're real characters. And then when they found out that I was an actor, they couldn't believe it. And then I started to, you know, to do some theater while I was on the job, and they would come and see the shows, and they gave me a lot of support.
So how long were you a firefighter?
For 4 years.
Was it a test of your courage in any way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the first time you go into a burning building, I mean, I did not want to go in. I couldn't believe I was going in. But I had the support of these guys with me. I worked for an engine company, and we work as a team. We go in with the hose, and our job is to put out the fire, as opposed to a hook and ladder company. Those guys, they split up. You know, they knock down the doors, they do searches, they ventilate. But in the engine company, you work close together as a team. Not that the hook and ladder guys don't work as a team, but on the engine, you're in there with these guys, you know, you're very close. And so with their help, I got through it. And then each time it got a little, not easier, but it was less frightening. I mean, you kind of learn to deal with it. And you know, you don't, I mean, I never really got over the fear, but you just learn to deal with it.
Any close calls while you were fighting fires?
There were a few times where I really felt like my life was in danger, but that was just part of it. I mean, there wasn't anything that happened where I was really hurt badly. So I think, you know, I mean, anytime you're in a burning building, it's, you know, you're in danger.
Mm-hmm. You said that when you're cast, you're often cast into seedy roles. Now, I know you grew up in Valley Stream, Long Island, which is, a pretty middle-class suburb of New York. Anything seedy about your upbringing?
Not really, no. You know, I just think that we all have different sides to us, you know, and so when I play those roles, you just tap into a darker side of your nature, and sometimes that's really fun to do. You know, it's a way of kind of living your darker dreams.
What were your darker dreams when you were young?
Well, you know, I mean, I used to think about... I mean, I used to do, like, petty stuff, you know, shoplift and all that. But to really do, you know, to be a career criminal, I think it takes a certain kind of a person, which I don't know that I could really do, but there is some part of me in there that finds that exciting.
Now, why did you want to shoplift? Was it for the excitement of doing it, or because you were broke and you needed things that you couldn't afford?
Well, I think both, you know. It was certainly the excitement of doing it was a big factor. But, yeah, I mean, I didn't have a lot of money, so it was just a way. I don't know if I was getting things I really needed, you know, but it was a way of getting things I wanted.
Did you ever get caught?
No, I never did. And I was in some pretty hairy situations there, too. I once robbed, like, 3 cases of beer in a bar. I was in the back room, and I didn't even want to do it. I was kind of forced into it. I'm pretty thin, and I was the only one who could fit through the bars on the back of the window. And my friends kind of like forced me in there and wouldn't let me leave until I kind of cleaned the place out. But a lot of my friends got caught. I mean, I was actually arrested once for criminal trespassing, but it was a stupid thing. I was thrown off the property of a Burger King. I guess I was being rowdy, and then I went back on the property later to get in my car, and the rent-a-cops came after me and kind of grabbed me. And I suppose I could have gotten away, but all my friends were around, and it just felt cool to kind of, you know, I kind of liked the attention I was getting of being caught, and the cops came and they arrested me and put me in handcuffs and put me in the car.
Well, Steve Buscemi, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Steve Buscemi co-stars in the new film Reservoir Dogs. He also stars in the new film In the Soup. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the Israelis' deportation of Palestinians?
Terry, we're looking at the story now as to what the effect is going to be on the peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. We also will have reports from Somalia. There's a briefing going on there today, and there's some indication of discussion of possible disarmament. We also have from Sylvia Poggioli a piece on Slobodan Milosevic, a kind of profile in anticipation of the elections, which are going to be held on Sunday, and a Christmas piece, a very beautiful choir from Minnesota called The Sounds of Blackness.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Arguably, the largest film industry in the world is located not in Hollywood, but in Bombay, India. The soundtracks for Indian movies draw on styles from a wide range of cultures and are as popular as the films themselves. World music critic Milo Miles explains how American audiences can get a screening of one master of Indian cinema music.
Sound was introduced to Indian films in 1931, and since then, the huge majority of productions have been musicals. Pop music is synonymous with film soundtracks in India, and hit songs attract an audience of hundreds of millions in the Middle East, Indonesia, and Africa as well. World music is by nature eclectic, but only Indian film songs seem to allow absolutely any combination of modes. Sweet string sections, stomping brass, reggae, disco, salsa, and country are sliced and recombined with carefree enthusiasm. But the result must not be a murky stew. Indian movie songs are thoroughly functional and have to underscore the mood of a scene, so there's no room for artistic statements or mere intellectual hijinks, which is not to say the songs lack vitality.
నోటబు చంద హాడలు చంద మౌనబు చంద ఓ సంగతి నీరువాగ ననబాళెల్ల ఆనంద ఓ సంగతి నీరువాగ ననబాళెల్ల ఆనంద.
The music we have been hearing is by composer Vijaya Anand, and there is an outstanding collection of his work available. But first, I should talk about a fine video introduction to Indian film music called There Will Always Be Stars in the Sky. This is part of British director Jeremy Marr's Beats of the Heart series, and it's particularly valuable in showing the types of performances Indian film music developed out of and has largely replaced. We get scenes of dancing gypsies, itinerant puppeteers, and a kind of Indian vaudeville doing a road show. The filmmakers seem to prefer the folk forms, if only because the entire performance can be filmed on the spot. Movie music is made in a modern, fragmented process that can't be seen all at once. Scenes that require songs are shown to composers who work material out with a select group of singers, and the final product is dubbed onto the actors. Turning out two or three songs a day is typical. Vijaya Anand has no problems with modernity on his album Dance Raja Dance. Indeed, he's particularly suited for rock and rap fans because he never threatens to turn into a berserk version of My Fair Lady. Dance Raja Dance amazes because though you never know what sound's coming next, Anand keeps everything in line with his sly logic and timing. Translations of lyrics are provided for Dance Raja Dance, and there's a few inspired lines. My favorite is, "When you flash your smile, I float in honey." But the words are often flowery, overdone tripe. The There Will Always Be Stars in the Sky video goes so far as to gently knock Indian film music as an opiate of the masses. But the addicted film fans plainly lust for escape. For many, the movies are the only place to get away from the poverty and squalor that fills their lives. You can't feel it's wrong to give them relief in rich and wondrous songs, but you wonder if it's enough.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge. The video, There Will Always Be Stars in the Sky, is available from Shaanicky Records. And Dance Raja Dance appears on the Luwaka Bop label. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk to comic Gilbert Gottfried. He's the whining voice of the wicked parrot in Aladdin. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.